So we're continuing our series through the book of Proverbs this evening. And if you were here a couple of weeks ago, you'd have heard John introducing us to Proverbs and setting us off with this central view behind the book of wisdom, which is Proverbs, which is the essence of wisdom is the fear of God. And that's a deep-seated respect and an honouring of God, not relying on our own ability or confidence. And one thing we need to keep in mind as we go through Proverbs is it's important to understand what Proverbs are and are not. Because they're not promises. They're not unconditional guarantees that we can claim. And we know that because we can find exceptions to virtually every single one of them if we look. But instead, they're short sayings that give advice or make an observation about the world. And they tell us how things generally go. They're general principles that are designed to give us wisdom, or to put another way, to give us advice about practical living. And that's skill in godly living. And Proverbs often uses a theme that's common throughout the Bible, this theme of two ways or two alternatives. And if you think about it, we see through the Bible two ways, two paths, two options, or two groups of people that we often see used to contrast one thing to another. And you can probably think of some. And someone here, if this is going to work. Oh, is it going to? Oh, hang on. If I turn it on, it might. Okay. Oh, no. Hang on. There we go. Right, so we're together now. So a few examples. So there's the sheep and the goats that we read about in Matthew chapter 25. We read about the narrow gate and the wide gate, and the narrow gate that leads to life, and the wide path that leads to destruction in Matthew chapter 7. And the Apostle John says that we either walk in darkness or we walk in light. And Jesus himself said, whoever is not with me is against me. Whoever does not gather with me scatters. And with Jesus, there's only two options. There's no grey area in between. They're sort of binary choices, if you like. And the Bible uses this approach often. And we see that continued in Proverbs. And in this little section we're going to think about tonight, we read about two opposites. We read about wisdom and we read about foolishness. And in Proverbs chapter 1, they're contrasted, okay? So we're going to read our passage, and as we do that, look for three groups of people talking, okay? There are three groups who have something to say about life, and we're going to look at these three groups tonight. There's parents, there's a gang, and then there's wisdom in this passage herself. So look out for those three. And Annie and Jordan are going to read our passage to us now, which is Proverbs chapter 1 and verses 8 to 33.
The reading is found on page 635 of the Chapel Bibles. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. They are a garland to grace your head and a chain to adorn your neck. My son, if sinful men entice you, do not give in to them. If they say, come along with us, let lie in wait for innocent blood, let ambush some harmless soul, let swallow them alive like the grave, and whole like those who go down to the pit. We will get all sorts of valuable things and fill our houses with plunder. Cast lots with us, we will all share the loot. My son, do not go along with them, do not set foot on their path. For their feet rush into evil, they are swift to shed blood. How useless to spread a net where every bird can see it. These men lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush only themselves. Such are the paths of all who go after ill-gotten gain. It takes away the life of those who get it.
Wisdom's rebuke. Out in the open, wisdom calls aloud. She raises her voice in the public square. On top of the wall, she cries out. At the city gates, she makes her speech. How long will you who are simple love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery, and fools hate knowledge? Repent at my rebuke. Then I will pour out my thoughts to you. I will make known to you my teachings. But since you refuse to listen when I call, and no one pays attention when I will stretch out my hand, since you disregard all my advice and do not accept my rebuke, I, in turn, will laugh when disaster strikes you. I will mock when calamity overtakes you, when calamity overtakes you like a storm, when disaster sweeps over you like a whirlwind, when distress and trouble overwhelm you. Then they will call to me, but I will not answer. They will look for me, but will not find me. Since they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord, since they would not accept my advice and spurn my rebuke, they will eat the fruit of their ways and be filled with the fruit of their schemes. For the waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in the safety and be at ease without fear of harm.
Thank you. Now, has anyone got any idea what this is? Oh, very good, Dave. It is. It's a flight simulator. This is a flight simulator. And I'm sure many of us will have seen or heard of these things, but I doubt many of us will have seen them in real life. They're used to train pilots, of course. And there's a cabin that you go into. You see the little door there. And it's mounted on this motion platform thing. And once you go inside, it's all very real because it's set out like the cockpit of a plane. And I have a friend in the RAF who told me that these simulators, they train you not only in the routines of flying, but they also train you in the what-if situations. And one of the more recent additions for training for commercial pilots is the scenario that happened in New York with Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger in 2009, where you might remember he safely landed his Airbus in the Hudson River. This was the press at the time. You may remember because he turned out as a bit of a hero because everyone managed to escape. And the what-if scenario that got added after this accident was, what if you're taking off from LaGuardia Airport and a flock of Canadian geese get sucked into your engines? And Captain Sullenberger said, one way of looking at this might be that for 42 years I've been making small regular deposits in this bank of experience, education and training. And then on January the 15th, 2009, the balance was sufficient that I could make a very large withdrawal. And here's something we might consider, that Proverbs is kind of our what-if life simulator. See, the book trains us not only for the routine of daily life, but also how to react to life's what-if situation, so that when those things happen, our reactions, they're more likely to be constructive than destructive. We're ready to cope with stuff that might not go as we might choose. So, as we consider this passage tonight, I thought we'd consider for a few minutes what we might learn from these three groups of people that are speaking in the passage. That's parents and gangs and there's wisdom. Okay, so first of all, we looked at the general principle of wisdom, which John talked about it in verse 7. And now we move into specific advice. So the verses 1 to 7 are about generally what wisdom is about, and wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And we get to the point where we're entering this book of wisdom with parents speaking. And verses 8 to 9 introduce the role of parents in passing on wisdom. Now, in our family, wisdom often takes the form of rules. Okay, rules intended over time to govern our behaviour. I'm not catching Julia's eye now. Mine included. And I asked our three children if they could recall any of Mum's rules from when they were younger. And within 20 minutes, they had dredged up over 40 rules for living in our family. And I've included a few of them as examples that you might be interested to know. And this is living proof of the power of parents, well, mums at least, handing down their wisdom. Julia can explain the three-strike rule if you ask her afterwards. Okay, so that's what wisdom looks like in our house. But first of all, but before we look at, sorry, at wisdom and foolishness, I'm going to dwell for a little bit, for the benefit of parents or those who know parents, on what it is that Proverbs chapter 1 says that wisdom from parents is really all about. Taken at face value, it seems to be pretty clear that parents have to be the ones who are doing the teaching, even when it can be tempting to leave others to do the job. Now, Solomon is giving advice to parents about their responsibility to pass on wisdom to children. Verses 8 and 9, they're a reminder to us. They're a reminder to us to listen, but they're also a reminder for parents to pass on wisdom. So if children need to hear the instruction of their father and obey the law of their mother, then that means that fathers have to be instructing and mothers have to be setting boundaries and holding firm to them. Now, many parents here, of course, will be doing a great job of sharing wisdom with their children, but there are a few lessons that I thought we could lift from this passage that offer practical advice. Stuff to add to your toolkit, if you like. And the first is this. Parents, teach your children with specificity about life. We're going to see throughout the book of Proverbs that there's real specificity. He talks about real specific instances and examples. So talk about specific scenarios and work through how your children might respond. Equip them for when that might happen for real. And we can probably anticipate some of the scenarios that our children will face. So if you teach your children the flight simulator method, if you would, so what if this happens? What if that happens? Give them scenarios that relate to their lives, because this is what Solomon goes on to do when he uses the illustration about joining a gang. And related to that, parents, don't just teach your children about the past. You know the line, when I was your age. But teach them about the future using future case studies. That's what we see here. Now, don't get me wrong, when you speak about your past, that's valid, but their eyes might roll up in their heads unless you've got some really juicy stories, I suspect, because they don't live in the past. When you speak about the future, you're showing interest in what may be facing them tomorrow. And one important element here is that you're anticipating a problem rather than reacting to one that's already happened. So when your friend tells you his parents are splitting up and he hasn't had a chance to do any preparation for the test you're doing tomorrow, so can he copy your answers? What will you do? And what will you say? Or when a pretty girl at a party invites you to her bedroom, and what will you do or say? Or if you're asked to pass on a group text that damages someone's reputation, even if it's true, and even if you don't like that person, what are you going to do? So help them make small, regular, very specific deposits in the bank of biblical experience so that the balance is sufficient that when they have to make a withdrawal, they'll be ready. Especially if that withdrawal might cost them popularity or friendships. And thirdly, parents, realise that you're just one of the voices that your children may hear, but not the only voice. Now, that's reasonably obvious, isn't it? But just to keep those voices in their life in perspective, you might want to regularly communicate to them that whatever the topic is, I'll probably know more about it than your friends do, without being a know-it-all. And secondly, whatever the topic, I'll always tell you the truth about it. So encourage them to come to you and keep those lines of communication open. Maybe they will or maybe they won't. But you keep the door open. And finally, parents, in case you feel like this is kind of you under the microscope, and I know it can be a misused phrase, but young people, the reason your parents teach you, maybe restrict you, is because they love you. And they're doing what the Bible says is wise for them to do. That they want what is for your best. But always remember, you're the ones ultimately who are accountable to God for the choices you make, and not your parents. And what's one of the implications here? Well, one of the implications is that wisdom can be learned, right? And it's an important principle underpinning the book of Proverbs. And to some extent, it's different to intellect, and I'm sure an educationalist, I'm avoiding looking that way just at the moment, will tell me I could be off beam. But I read an article suggesting that intellect is essentially genetic. By contrast, wisdom is something that can be taught and something that can be learned. So in Proverbs chapter 1, the son has a choice to make. Will he choose the practice of wisdom or will he be a fool? And it's up to him. This is implied throughout the book. So that was a little detour about advice to parents. And we're now going to go back to the overall message about wisdom. And we look at foolishness from gang. So we heard about what parents have to say and their responsibilities. And then the second group speaking here are gangs. Okay, so what do we learn from gangs? What's the specific advice? The first specific proverb in the book of Proverbs, and it's this: don't join a gang. So you have this big build-up, and then the first specific proverb is don't join a gang. And I looked at it and I thought, really? Really? Isn't that so obvious that it doesn't need saying? But the point is, it's an example. It's an example about a more general point, which is this. If sinners call you, if people who don't love God call you, try to attract you, or to tempt you, don't consent. Don't go with them. Gangs here are an analogy for temptation. The example is an example of the way sinners can entice. So it's a bad thing, of course, to hang around with people who mug others and kill people and who take their stuff. Of course it is. But is that the only way we're enticed, the only way we're tempted? No, of course it's not. The example about gangs is poetry. It's a poetic picture about mugging. And I imagine Solomon uses this picture because it was so prevalent in those days. His son, David, he was talking to at the time, would have known that it was unsafe to walk on his own and that the chances of getting robbed alongside the roadways at the time was really pretty high. And so it's an example that would have struck a chord with his son at the time. So because of that, people had to travel in large groups. But it's not the only folly that cries out to the unwise person. And I'm sure that most of us have never been recruited into a gang of thugs and murderers. I'll just check in, see if I get any nods. And the armed forces don't count, by the way. But we're tempted, nevertheless, aren't we, all the time. And folly cries out to us in lots of different ways. If you just think about the internet, the many temptations, the many that cry out to us. How easy online gambling promises money for us to be. And they say all these things, don't they? These characters say, come, throw your lot in with us. We'll make you rich, we'll make you happy, and we'll make you secure. Because folly is always crying out, and that's what we see with gangs here. And in contrast, wisdom says, don't go there. When they come, when they're calling, it says, don't go there. And we could take the example from Joseph, a young, successful, good-looking guy. He was in charge of the whole of Potiphar's household, and there's only one thing he wasn't allowed to touch, which was Potiphar's wife. And the time came when she came to Joseph and she said, let's go to bed. And the only thing that he could do was what? He ran. He just ran away. And that's what wisdom is telling us. Run away. Get away from temptation when it comes your way. Don't go there. So whatever it is that you struggle with, just don't go there because it's folly and it's sin and it's a trap. So those men who come who are saying, come, join us, throw your lot in with us. It's a trap of some form or another. And if you look at verse 17, so before shotguns and the like, birds will be caught with traps. Now, I can't quite picture how that would work. In my head, I imagine something like Wile E. Coyote trying to lure Roadrunner into his latest acme trap with the promise of birdseed. But what he's saying here is even a bird is smart enough to know that if someone is setting a trap right in front of you, then the bird's going to go, something is not right here. I think I'm going to fly away. And they fly away. So a bird is bright enough to fly away from a trap that's laid right in front of them. But often we don't. We might go, oh look, free naked girls. Wow, buy one, get one free, shoe sales. The enemies of our souls, especially the shoe sales. And they lay the traps. And the murdering thieves here will eventually be caught because they say we fall into the traps that are laid for us. But of course, we don't have to answer folly's call. Because then we get warning from wisdom. And as we look later in the chapter at verses 20 to 33, the speaker then moves, having been parents, then gangs, to wisdom. And wisdom is personified here as a woman, and often the case in Proverbs, she's personified as a woman. And her message is almost exactly the opposite of gangs. So she's in the open marketplace, she's proclaiming her message to people passing by who just aren't interested. But when calamity comes their way, because they ignored her, she will not be available to them. Had they listened to her, they would have saved themselves a load of trouble. So where the gang scenario might seem a bit unrealistic, because none of us can picture gangs very easily, wisdom maybe seems a little cruel because suddenly she's not available. So look, before we look at that, let's make some contrasts between wisdom and the gang. And I think we'll see more clearly that this is principle-based. There are six quick lessons and six contrasts between wisdom and the gang here. So first, and probably the most obvious difference, is that it's a group of people who are enticing Solomon's son to sin, whereas wisdom is just a lone voice. And we could think of it as peer pressure, the mob mentality, and it's what happens when we fear men instead of fearing God. And there's a saying in Tolstoy, I don't know if you've ever read Anna Karenina, which is, happy families are all alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And sometimes it's called the Anna Karenina principle. And you may have heard of that. The idea is that things can go right in only one way. Like a car, everything's got to work for it to work properly. The engine, the gearbox, the fuel system, and so on. But they can go wrong in lots of different ways. And there's a host of things that can go wrong. Sorry, and that's true of wisdom, rather. There's one great way to be wise. One lone wise voice, and a whole load of ways to be foolish. And a whole mass of voices calling us to be foolish. So we need to be prepared to listen to the lone voice. If you look across the Bible, there are many, many godly people who are lone voices speaking wisdom. Noah, Moses, Joshua, David, Elijah, Isaiah, Nehemiah, John the Baptist, Jesus, Paul, and we could go on. We could think of many, many people who just were lone voices at the time. And they were very often the only ones proclaiming the true message of God at the time. So secondly, wisdom is out in the open, whereas sinners or foolishness are hidden. And the Apostle John talks about unbelievers walking in darkness. And remember when what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. Once they disobeyed God, they hid. Or perhaps another way to think about it is that wisdom is accountable. Those who are wise allow themselves to be tested by others to see if they've truly got godly wisdom or worldly wisdom. And the third contrast is that wisdom is ruled by knowledge, whereas sin tends to be ruled by emotion. We see a number of instances of that in this passage. So wisdom is all about proclaiming knowledge and insight and understanding that is based on the fear of the Lord. It's about knowing the right thing and doing the right thing. It's about knowing what's right and what the right thing is and being self-controlled enough when temptation comes your way to be able to do it. By contrast, if you look back at the gangs, they're all about emotions. They're all about enticement and greed and social acceptance. There's nothing about knowledge with them, only foolishness, simplicity and excitement. Now, and I'm not saying that excitement is a bad thing or emotions are necessarily bad, because God gave us emotions. But emotions are not to be trusted on their own because they're informed by knowledge. And the fourth contrast is that wisdom has compassion on the ignorant, whilst the gangs or foolishness attacks the ignorant. So where the world, those on the path of wickedness, they hate those who are innocent. Wisdom has compassion on them. And wisdom calls out to them and pleads to them in the open market. That's a challenge to us, isn't it? Because we're commanded in 1 Timothy chapter 2 to plead with and pray for those people. Now, Jonathan Edwards, a pastor in the 1700s, he had a series of resolutions that he wrote when I think he was a teenager. And there were 70 things that he resolved to do throughout his life to please the Lord. And resolution 15 goes like this. Resolved never to suffer the least motions of anger towards irrational beings. And he knew that irrational beings, irrational people, can often make us angry. But he also knew their eternal outcome. And he also knew what his own life looked like and his own destiny looked like before salvation. Let's read in Titus chapter 3. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another. So he recognized that every believer was once on the same path, the same destination, doing the same kind of foolish stuff. And another comparison then is that gangs are motivated by financial gain, whereas wisdom is motivated by spiritual gain. Of course, we know money doesn't last long and it can make people do foolish things. But wisdom knows two things. First of all, everything is God's, money included. Our money's not our own, it's God's money. When we come at money with that perspective, when we think about money and spend money, it changes. Our approach to money changes. And second, wisdom knows that true riches aren't physical anyway, but they're spiritual. Paul says in Ephesians that in the coming ages, God is going to lavish on his believers his immeasurable riches of grace and kindness in Christ Jesus. And that's true riches, isn't it? Being rich eternally is what matters. And those riches come through faith in Jesus Christ alone. He promises to reward believers for how they serve the Lord after they're saved. And the sixth and final contrast is that wisdom loves rebuke, where the gang loves its simplicity. So a lot of people who might be foolish, in fact, take pride in their foolishness. They might brag about their ungodly decisions. They might love being simple. They might love their sin. And Jesus said in John chapter 3 and 9, verse 19, that the reason people reject him is because they love darkness rather than the light, because their works are evil. They love their sin more than they love Jesus. They know Jesus calls them to repentance, calls them to turn from their selfish ways and submit everything to him. But they don't like that trade, and so they reject him. But wisdom, by comparison, loves rebuke and correction. We'll read later in Proverbs chapter 17, a rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding than 100 blows into a fool. You could punch a fool all day long and they won't change a thing. But rebuke a wise man and they'll put it into practice. And it sounds a little bit circular, doesn't it, in a sense? But those who are wise don't want to be foolish. They want to know where they're going astray and they ask for input and feedback and correction. And sometimes that might be really, really hard to take, but they want it nonetheless. So wisdom continues then in verses 24 to 31 and gives us some blunt, sobering news. This is what happens if you continue to ignore God's call on your life. If you continue down the wrong road. Now, these are verses that predict prolonged rejection in terms of cause and effect. The cause is that they reject God's wisdom. You look at the terms used in verses 24 and 25. You refused. No one paid attention. You neglected, you did not want my reproof. People don't reject wisdom for folly, they reject wisdom as folly. In their minds, they're smarter than anyone else, even when wisdom has been freely available to them. She calls out loud in the public places. And when they're heading down that road, God warns them there's a point of no return. And the effect is found in verses 26 to 31. And in New Testament terms, it's God gave them over. God gave them over. There's a point of no return. And as you read, wisdom may come across as cruel here. Because in these verses, wisdom laughs at those who are going to be judged. Remember this phrase? Justice is getting what I deserve. Mercy is not getting what I deserve. Grace is getting what I don't deserve. And that's God's forgiveness in Jesus Christ. But these are people who are saying, I don't want grace. These are people who are saying, I don't want mercy. And these people are saying, I want justice. And that's what they receive. Because hardness of heart inherits itself. C.S. Lewis once wrote, there are only two kinds of people in the end. There are those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, in the end, thy will be done. And you either fear the Lord or you turn your back on him. Look at the contrast. Look again at verse 7 that John talked about a couple of weeks ago. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And then look at verse 29. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. And it's a critical contrast for us to understand. And then the conclusion is in verses 32 to 33. For the waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But here's the final promise. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. You want to be secure? You want to have eternal certainty? Then listen to him. And verse 33 offers an almost, it's almost a whosoever will term, isn't it? He who listens to me, that's not limited. It's open to anyone. He who listens to me, every one of us, is on one of those two paths. Remember the comparisons of two we started with at the start of the sermon? Which one are we on? So I love the whosoever will here in verse 33 because God's grace is open to all who would listen to him. You might be a young fool, you might be an old fool, but every fool can come to Jesus and say, Lord, left to myself, I am what Proverbs describes as a fool. I'm a sinner who needs your grace to be saved and forgiven. And then I need your grace to continue as I walk with you. I just need you, Lord. I'm open. I am one of the whosoever will. I want your wisdom. And that's a wonderful truth, isn't it? So our desire is that we turn to God and we let him do what he wants to do in our lives, which is enfold you in his arms of wisdom. And here's what his desire is for you, that your desires will become his desires and his will become yours. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding, and in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Amen.